And if you buy a bunch of books in French and you send them to us in Las Vegas, we'll scan them for you absolutely free, and we'll get our distributed proofreaders of Europe onto that, and we'll get you the books back in a way that they've been proofread hopefully twice and good enough for you to start with. Now, obviously, none of the things we do are 100%. I don't know if anybody, I've never read a book in my life that didn't have at least one mistake in it. Right now, our goal is to have it 99.95% accurate when you get it. Then it'd be nice if you sent us an email and says, hey, stupid, you forgot to capitalize Balzac on page 15. No, we like getting messages like that. You can leave out the hey, stupid, if you want, but a lot of people email Project Gutenberg, and they say, I met this crazy guy at the airport who gave me an electronic book on my PDA. Do you forward this to him? And that's me. Oh, you're not happy with this? Oh, that's good. That was a good shake of your head. Okay. No. He was about ready to shoot me.
I really would like you to take, let's say, 10, 15 minutes to provide us calmly with a background about the Gutenberg project, how it is done.
Okay.
Who are
everyone should get you up to the 10 of the show. That way, no matter how many blades are down, no matter how many viruses are running around, no matter how many power outages are gone and the whole wilderness space is dark, you can still get books. Now, how it's organized, again, I have to say to a certain point, I'm lucky. There are people who have volunteered to help me that I met on this trip. My first stop on this trip was San Francisco, where I met a bunch of the distributed proofreaders. I had met one of them before, just passing through an airport. And, hello, how are you? Let's have a sandwich. Your plane's leaving. That was it. And we had a five-day conference there in San Francisco. And I don't like conferences. I usually think it's a waste of time. I was totally amazed. No, it's not easy to amaze me. I amaze everybody else. It's not easy to amaze me. These people didn't talk about anything other than the work they were doing. Usually at a conference, they're all talking about all sorts of things besides what they're there for. That just blew me away. I was stunned. The quality of these people. One of our biggest distributed proofreader people is Juliet Sutherland. For those of you who've been familiar with computers forever and ever and ever, know about Evans and Sutherland, which was the first CAD/CAM machines, million-dollar computers for making machinery. CAD/CAM, computer-aided design, computer-aided machining. Her father designed all this stuff, and she's been doing computers since she was 2 years old. Totally amazing people. I don't pay them a penny, not one centime. They like what they're doing. I thought I would never find, I mean, years and years and years when I first started this, I tried to find who is going to replace me. Even when I was just 25, 30 years old, I was already trying to find out who would replace me when I was dead, or just too old to be coherent anymore. And I couldn't find anybody who even wanted to. And now I have a handful of people, and it was magic. You know how they say, when you stop looking for something, it materializes right in front of you. And I finally just stopped asking what was going to happen, and these people just popped up. Distributed proofreaders, which is one of the biggest organizations on the internet and one of the most famous, I had nothing to do with it coming about. Nothing. It happened all by itself. It was just a bunch of people who liked what I was doing and said, we're going to help. Right out of the blue, just fell out of the sky. I love it. I love it. These people are much more organized than I am. You look at me, anytime you come and hear me speak, you don't see any paper in front of me. I don't have any notes. I have always a half a dozen things that I really want to say. I usually manage to get in about half of them because I'm what they call a dynamic speaker. I want to talk about what you want to hear. I don't want to talk about what I already know this stuff. It's the reaction. She gets me to talk to her because she reacts to me. You know, the people who ask the questions, squeaky wheel gets the grease. So we have people who are much more organized than I am. I hate paperwork. All I want to do is get the work done. But somehow, and I'm not sure how this works, because when I was a kid, I could organize adventures, but I could never organize work. Nobody ever wanted to do work that I wanted to do. And now, somehow, I don't know what it is. They say I have a right personality for this, but I don't know. I think I have a very strange personality. But somehow, they say there's no greater force than an idea that is in its time. I think a lot of this works just because it's a great idea. To me, this is the very first step in the neo-industrial revolution. I personally think that the reason they made the copyright laws longer was not for them to make more money, because they're only going to make 1% more money. Most books are out of print in a couple years. They're never going to make another penny, no matter how many. And even, you know, even Jaws, the movie that made $100 million in the first week, well, it's never going to make $500 million. No matter, they could run it for 500 years, and it would never, it's already, you know, nobody watched it. It never makes any money anymore. The reason that this copyright is getting longer is because these people are not quite as dumb as they look. And eventually, you'll be able, and I'm going to lose somebody. Some of you are going to just think I'm totally nuts here. But eventually, you're going to be able to print out a can of Pepsi and drink it. And it's not as far away as you think. I have things, physical objects, that were printed out of a computer that are physical objects this big. Now, they're not made out of tin and coke, but if you just remember back 20 years in computing, there was only one color, green. All right, you remember? All the screens were green. Getting an amber screen was kind of funny, okay? And then we got screens that had 8 colors and 16 colors and 32 and 64 and 128 and 256. 256 colors was amazing. It was. IBM spent millions of dollars showing off how cute these pictures were. I know I'm off topic. I'm sorry. We now, probably none of you have a computer that doesn't do 16 million colors. We have these printers that print three-dimensional objects. They only have one color or two colors or three different kinds of things they can print with. But when you think of how short a time it took from being able to print in one color to being able to print in 16 million colors, I think you could be able to print out the Venus de Milo and have it be within a millionth of an inch of resolution. Okay, I'm sorry, I've gone off topic here.
Yeah, there are more questions from colleagues, please.
Do you have an agreement with Gallica, which is a French e-book project of the National Library in France?
I don't think so. And I also remember the three-letter one, the UBA.
If I understood correctly, they allowed the distributed proofreaders to use their scans. To OCR and then proofread. You should explain what distributed proofreaders are. Not every people know it here.
Okay. But what about the agreement?
So they have scanned part of their books, and they have OCR'd yet another part of that part.
Okay.
But I think DP can use the scans, if I understood correctly.
They get about 10,000 titles in text, just in text. I mean, not images.
Yeah. Great.
You understand what I mean?
Yes.
They have books and images and text. But DP redo the text.
we are making arrangements with more and more places. Sadly to say that one of the things that we find hard to do with Project Gutenberg is to change the paradigm. You all know the word paradigm? Like the world used to be flat, and now it's not. That's you change the way you look at the world in a big way. The entire civilization of the world has been built on limited distribution. Whole idea was, if I have this, you can't have it. Okay? And that there was never enough for everybody. Up until 1971, there was only one thing in all history that all of you could have all you wanted of. Who can tell me what it was? Very good. You're smart. That's the fastest I asked this 100 times at different speeches. I guess the fastest I ever got the answer. There was, of course, never any man-made things you could have. No machine-made things. The Industrial Revolution allowed us to have a greater number of things, but still you couldn't have all you wanted unless you were incredibly rich. That first electronic thing I typed in on the teletype machine back in 1971 was the Declaration of Independence. It just happened to be the 4th of July, and why not? That's 5,000 characters. Today, if you buy, we bought the, what was it, a 160 gigabyte drive was what we bought for $60 when I left on this trip. And the number of copies of the Declaration of Independence that you could put on that drive is, I'm going to have to do the math, which you got 5,000 to 5 million to 5 billion. It's a million copies, then times 16. 16 million, you can have 16 million copies. That should be enough for almost anybody. And it doesn't cost anything. This is the basic idea of what happened in the Industrial Revolution. But in the Neo-Industrial Revolution, it doesn't just change from a little to a lot. It changes to almost infinite. Very, very close to you could have, if anybody here really wanted a million copies of one of these books, you could have it without spending as much enough money to worry about. When nuclear energy was introduced in the United States, they came up with this slogan to try to hypnotize us into accepting it, saying, "Electricity too cheap to meter." It was electricity that was so cheap that it would cost you more to meter it than it would cost to provide the electricity. Well, this is one of the ideas of Project Gutenberg. Electronic books that are truly too cheap to meter. If everybody that ever had one of these sent me a penny, I would have $10 billion. I could buy out Donald Trump. But I have something that's more powerful than buying out Donald Trump, I changed the world. So I'm not so modest. Sorry.
Yeah.
We got him fighting with you.
My name is Alain Le Goeux. I'm from an organization for the blind. Congratulations for your project and all you have done. I think that you may know the American organization called Bookshare, which is trying to give books to the blind and low vision people. Can you tell us what is the difference and why you could not have a part on your file server which could be dedicated to this type of books? I think it's probably copyright problems.
People who have visual impairments have certain rights in the United States that other people don't have. They can make a copy of the book. It's illegal for me to make it for them. It's a really weird country. I have tried to make some deals with various, I don't know if you know George Kircher, yeah? And sadly to say, if you know him, then you know that he doesn't get along with somebody like me because he's very formal. He's very political, he's very business-oriented, and the people always say, what's the business model for Project Gutenberg? I'm right, like there's a business model. these people, and this is one of the reasons why I was talking about the paradigm shift, is they consider power to be something to be held close. And I consider power to be something to be given away. Now, I'm going to give you a little example. I'm going to spend 1 minute on this. My father was a Shakespeare professor. It was one of the keys as to how come we have Project Gutenberg, because he was also an electronic hi-fi nut, and my mother was a math professor. People always ask, how did you come up with this idea? Well, obviously, it wasn't as hard for me as it was for somebody else, because I had the right pieces. But the point here is that power, I'm going to imitate two different Shakespeare professors, okay? One of them says, I am the world's greatest Shakespeare professor because I know three things about Shakespeare that nobody else is ever going to know. I can win a game of Trivial Pursuit with Shakespeare. I can go on Alex Trebek Jeopardy, and I can win, and you don't know. I am so cool, and you are nothing. You peasant. Okay, now here's the other Shakespeare professor who says, I'm the world's greatest Shakespeare professor because I've taught more Shakespeare to more people than anybody else. One of them holds the power in and says, this is what power is. One of them lets the power go and says, that's what power is. The Industrial Revolution was a case where the power started to get away. By the way, if you study your history, every one of these ages, the age of industry, the age of exploration, even the age of reason, had a very big component of only certain people get to play this game. You had to have a license from the king or the queen or whoever to go out and be part of the age of exploration. I would have got killed off right away back in those days, or else I would have become Columbus, I'm not sure which. But I admire those guys. Okay, now, are we going? Did I answer okay?
I think, thank you very much for your answer, because it's the main reason because the blind and low vision people have so few books sometimes.
I have a personal project to put every one of our books into Braille. I know a lot of people don't read Braille anymore, but it's an easy thing for a computer to do, and it's just one of my, it's been a personal thing for me for the last 10 years, and we are going to make it. It's just nobody wants to help me, so it's taken a while. Okay? So if you find any volunteers, let me know. You.
Hello. Do we hear me? Yes. Tariq Rim. I had a question regarding the future, like, let's say, a couple hundred years in front of us. I guess one of the biggest issues right now is dealing with copyright and digitalization, but one of the biggest issues in a couple of hundred years and more is going to be that the books, the physical books, have disappeared and we will have only digitalized books. And one of the major issues I see is when we see what's happening right now with censors and everything, you have, how do you, I'm not talking about typos, regular typos, but how can you ensure in the 10,000 years to come up that the books you're translating, you're adapting,
they're the right stuff.
Are the right stuff? And are you thinking of some kind of protection? I mean, when you see what's happening with free software and the GPL, you have the ability to keep the software free at least. Would you have?
I got the question.
Yes.
Okay. First. Every computer operating system comes with a program like comp or diff or something like that. If somebody changes one colon to a semicolon, it'll tell you. and he'll tell you in 1 second. So as long as there are 12,000 copies of Taming of the Shrew out there, you can find out very easily if the one you got was doctored up any. Okay? Somebody would have to go out there and change them all to get away with this.
But this is for the electronic, toward another electronic books, but what will be happen when the physical book that was the original one is not here any longer? I mean, you can of course see difference between a couple of books, but the physical, the original physical books that serve for this, how can you do that when you will have only internet-based book?
With those programs like Comp, you could run Compare on 10,000 copies of the book. You can figure out by looking at the file sizes and the file dates and everything which of these books went back, if you want the one that was from 800 years ago and not the one that was from 900 years ago. You can figure that out with a computer. That's not a big deal. We were very worried about that. We called it 1984-ism, and we were very worried when we started, which is why when you go to Project Gutenberg, if you get in there yourself, not using one of these browsers or other interfaces, but if you go right to the directory, you can find all the old editions. We don't delete them when we put in the new ones. Even though we're correcting typos that, you know, we're 99.99% sure that was a typo. And by the way, you know, I can't emphasize this too much for people who get overly scholarly, but these people argue still, even when they have the paper book in front of them, whether this was a comma or a period or a semicolon because of the way it was printed. And I will email, I have a big article about that that I've written over the years, and I'll email it to you. I'm not particularly concerned whether it's to be comma or not to be, or to be semicolon or not to be, or in, you know, if I can get a million people to read Shakespeare, I'm happy. And,
s'il vous plaît.
Merci beaucoup. Mahmoud Ouraba, consultant en économie du développement. Je m'excuse de revenir un peu à cette histoire du marché qui domine le monde. Vous avez ouvert l'appétit tout à l'heure avec beaucoup de passion en ce qui concerne les moments où vous avez parlé des problèmes que vous aviez ou que vous avez... où j'ai compris que vous aviez un certain nombre, disons, de problèmes avec les problèmes des droits d'auteur. C'est effectivement très passionnant cet aspect des choses de votre exposé. Je voulais juste savoir si également vous avez des problèmes où vous pouvez subodorer quelques problèmes avec le monde de l'édition. Merci.
Well, I don't think I have to expect them. I think they're staring us right in the face. I mean, I started Project Gutenberg in 1971, and in 1976, the United States copyright changed from 28 years plus 28 years for a possible total of 56 to 75 years, and you did not have to renew in the middle. Even though 90% of all copyrights ever issued in the United States were never renewed, and the cost was what we call nominal. Yeah. Anybody who wanted to renew the copyright could certainly afford it. You send in a letter, they sent you a form, you send in $25, and bingo, that was it. My own, how much time do we have? I would like to spend like 5 minutes on this question.
We still have about 35 minutes. We finish at 12.
And as I said before, anybody who wants to talk to me afterwards, all you have to do is get me to the metro and help me get home. I'll talk to you as long as you want. This is a very important point, though, so I'm going to spend a little extra time on it. I hate talking about this, but it's important. Usually, and it's good that it's at the end. People ask me at the beginning, usually, and I say, ask me again at the end. I'll give you a little history of copyright. and it's bad. And don't forget, though, that it's from an American's point of view, okay? I know a lot more about American copyright than I know about the European copyright. Our copyright, as we have a historical foundation for it, started in about 1709 or 1710 with the Statute of Anne in England. Now, I don't know how many of you have studied from Henry II and Richard III and Eleanor of Aquitaine up to Henry VIII and then Elizabeth I and Queen Mary and Queen Anne, but it's really exciting. And all during that period, the Stationers' Company, previously the Stationers' Guild, was lobbying their little brains out to try to stop the Gutenberg press. Okay? Before Gutenberg, these 1% of the most educated people who could write well enough to copy a book had a virtual monopoly on everything you could read. You had to go to the Stationers' Guild or the Stationers' Company to get a copy. And you had to pay them whatever they wanted. And they made a copy for themselves to boot. I mean, it's a racket, as we call it in the United States. And they wanted to get that monopoly back. Because in 1455, Johann Gutenberg screwed it all up for them. Times changed. The paradigm changed. We had this huge change. And we talked about literacy in Africa and everything else, and it's going to be the same as it was with Gutenberg. Before Gutenberg, the illiteracy rate was 99%. After Gutenberg, let's just say it was 50%. Okay? It would be nice. I would be perfectly happy, rest very nicely in my grave, if I increased the literacy rate by 10, 15%. That's happy for me. I did a good job. I can sleep well. What happens when the world changes is that a lot of people try to stop it from changing. And especially where money is concerned. This is why it confuses everybody so much when I say I don't deal with money. They just don't know how to, they don't know how to attack me because I don't deal with money. Okay. So we got 1709, we got for 50 years at least prior to 1709 and 1710, every year the Stationers Guild and Stationers Company applies for what was then called a patent, but it was a copyright. It turned out to be a copyright in the end. And on this one particular day, the number of legal printing presses in the United Kingdom went from hundreds to one dozen. And all of those dozen were in London. The monopoly was back into effect. You had to come to London, you had to play their game, and it was not just profit, it was also censorship. Because if they didn't like your book, there was only 12 of them, they could just send messages to each other, don't print that jerk's book, I don't like them. All right? Not only that, but the first 14 years of the copyright went to the publisher, not to the author. And only if the author was still alive after the 14 years and wanted to keep the book in print could they apply for the 14-year extension. You couldn't sell that to somebody. You couldn't give it to your heirs. It was meant for you to be able to make a certain amount of money for a certain amount of time. And then if you wanted to make more money, you had to do some more work. This becomes very important later. That's why I emphasize it so much. Okay. The number of books in print in England went from 6,000 to 600 right then. Okay. So we have Gutenberg inventing the printing press in 1455. It takes them basically 250 years to figure out how to get their monopoly back. These guys were not the smartest tacks, the smartest nails in the box, the sharpest nails in the box. But it took them 250 years. They finally got their monopoly back. For those of you who study American history, you've heard of the pamphleteers. I'm sure none of you have heard of it because even the people I talk to in the United States have. But I studied it, and I never knew why the pamphleteers were so important. And these were the illegal printing presses in the United States that weren't controlled by the Stationers Guild, and it's how we informed everybody of what the revolution was doing. Okay, now we're going to jump forwards a long time to around 1900. In 1900, technology changed again. There was almost a new industrial revolution. We had huge steam engines and electric motors. And new printing presses were invented to run on these engines. And you could buy one of these printing presses for very cheap and make what we call a zillion books overnight. At the same time, the railroad network in the United States had just gone coast to coast to everywhere. So you could move out into the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, in the middle of nothing, and set up this printing press, fill up a boxcar full of books, and send one of them to New York, and one of them to San Francisco, and one of them to anywhere you wanted for no money. We ended up with a whole bunch of new publishers who bought these new printing presses. And if you go to bookstores, used bookstores in the United States, you'll still see these fantastic collections of books dated around 1900. Everything anybody ever wanted to know about, and then this subject. And you'd buy this set of 8 books, everything ever written about hydraulics more than 14 years ago. Everything ever written about steam engines, everything ever written about law, everything ever written about medicine, everything that was in the public domain, all of a sudden could be bought for $5 or $10. This had the same reaction. In fact, we use the term reactionary for what the publishers did. The old publishers ganged up on the new publishers. They went to Congress, Washington, D.C., probably bribed a bunch of people, and passed a law that says, you can't do that anymore. Why should we compete with you when we can have somebody sign a bill that says, it's illegal, go away? So the publishing industry changed from 14 years, 90% of them expiring in 14 years, to 90% of them expiring in 28 years. And all of a sudden, all these reprint houses would have to retool all their books to make them legal again. They have to take out all the information that was between 14 and 28 years ago. Well, they couldn't afford to do that, and 90% of them went out of business, and that was the end of that. Now we jump forward to 1976. What was invented around then? The Xerox machine. The reactionary reaction, again, was, why should we compete with anybody when we can make it illegal? It gets faster each time, too. They just look in history and go, oh, anytime anybody invents any way for the masses to get what used to go to only the rich people, we're going to make it illegal. So we have 1710, 1909, 1976, and then 1998, where there was a Supreme Court case in the United States that originally was called Hart versus Reno. Hart, same walk. But when they wrote it up, they wrote it up so poorly, I said, no, you have to take my name off of it. Lawyers are very strange people, I'm sure you know, and they were never trying to win. And I just said, no, you have to do a better job than that if you're going to put my name on it. So it became Eldred versus Ashcroft, which I'm sure some of you have heard of. And they lost big because they didn't do it right. All right, anyway. So we got another copyright extension in 1998. So between 1909 and 1998, 89 years, copyright essentially got extended in the United States by 80 years. in only 89 years. Virtually nothing was going to the public domain. Now, I had sent some emails asking to get a stack of paper plates, and I didn't get them. And so you're going to have to use your imagination, and this is a little hard for a lot of people. I apologize. This has never worked for me before, so I'm only going to do it for 1 minute. But I want you to imagine I have a stack of 100 paper plates, and I take 50 here and 50 there, and I say, 100 years ago in the United States, half of the books that had ever been copyrighted were still in copyright, and half had expired into the public domain, because information was doubling about every 14 years. So a 14-year copyright was pretty good. It meant half the information you had to pay for and half of it was free. That's all right. I can live with that. And also, I can live with the fact that if I buy a book and I really like it, I says, 14 years down the road, very likely I can republish it myself. I can wait that long. All right? Then, all of a sudden, it becomes 28 years instead of 14 years. And now, I take half of this pile and I put it in that pile. And I say, we got a lot more information under copyright than we have in the public domain. Now, at the same time, two things are happening. They're changing the law. And now, I'm sure all of you know, information is doubling much more quickly than once every 14 years. Even without passing a law, the percentage, I'm going to go back to the 100 over here, the percentage would still be, if you had 14 years, they say that information is doubling about every 2 years. I try to be a little more conservative than that, but I'll do the math for you. You would get half public domain after 2 years. You would get a quarter after 4 years. You'd get three quarters after 6 years. In 8 years, you would get 7/8, and in 10 years, you would get 15/16, and in 12 years, you would get 31 out of 32. It keeps going on, and at 14, you would, actually, I missed one, sorry. At 14, you would get 1 out of 128. If information was doubling every 2 years, and it was all copyrighted, and we made all of it, everything free to start with, and now you start this new stuff, after 2 years, half of it, you'd get double, so this new double would be copyrighted, and the old piece would be not copyrighted. Then you'd have twice as much as that, and that. So you would still end up with over 99% of all the information would still be under copyright. But that's not enough for the publishing industry. 99% is not enough. Because they want you to pay attention only to what they give you. They want to be the only providers of information, and they want all the information to be pay per whatever. Pay per view, pay for a copy, you have to watch an advertisement. Now, that's enough of that topic. I don't like to talk about that, but that's the real answer to your question about the publishers. And it, from their perspective, it's war. I'll give you just one example. Disney in 1998, they're the ones who major passed this law. All the guys from Disney were sitting in the front. And by the way, if you've understood anything about my personality by now, you understand that it was a very good thing that I did not go to the Supreme Court personally, because my friend Eric Eldred did go, and he had to sit as that black person sitting way back in the back. We have a person named Rosa Parks, who you never heard of, but she was a black lady who had to sit in the back of the bus in 1954, and she refused. Oh, you know who she is? Okay. Well, I would have had to sit in that seat in the Supreme Court while the guys from Disney sat up here. Can you imagine what kind of noise I would have made? It would have been a big fight. So it's a good thing that Eldred went instead of me, because he's quieter than I am. Anyway, that's enough of that topic. But the reason Disney paid $200 million extra in 1998 just for the single copyright to Winnie the Pooh. You heard of Winnie the Pooh and Tigger and Eeyore and all? Just for that one copyright, because it was going to expire right around then, too. So they had to pay for 20 more years because of their own law. So you can imagine if they spent $200 million on that one copyright, how much they spent to make sure this law passed. And it's no wonder that the case 7-2. It should have been five to four. But let's face it, we never had a chance. I tried to talk to the senators, and they wouldn't talk to me. So,
have you published a paper summing up what you just said about copyright? Because this is really a fascinating story. I would like to read it if you could tell us where
we could find it.
I'm very strange about publishing. I write a new article every time somebody asks me. Why? Because I look at the old ones, and I go, oh, I can't believe I wrote something so bad.
It would be a good paper.
So you have my email address, right? You send me and say, tell me the story about 1709 to 1998, and I will write it all over, because if I look at the old one, I'll be so unhappy with it that I won't send it. But I have published this story a dozen times.
Thank you so much. More questions, please.
Julien Meunier, I'm a computer science student. Have you ever refused to put a book in the Gutenberg project because of its content?
Have I refused?
To put a book in your Gutenberg project because of the content.
Did everybody hear the question? I barely. Okay. Have I refused to publish anything? Probably half a dozen books, maybe. We had The Pearl, Fanny Hill, and something else of that nature, and I gave them to, I didn't refuse to publish them, I just gave them to somebody else and asked them to publish them. I try to make sure, especially when I told them after we got to number 10,000, I would come up with a Project Gutenberg number 2, which was working on in Hawaii just before I came over here, and we do riskier things at Project Gutenberg number 2. There is also people who are what we call vanity press, who they've written something that nobody wants to publish in the whole world, and it's really bad. And I still read them. People send them. I still answer all my own email. I don't know how I manage it. I'm just very, very hyper, and I do it very fast. If all of you email me at once and the same day, I guarantee you I will answer you all that day when it gets to me. Obviously, I was behind from my travels, but... I got 10, you already heard all that, so we try not to, but you never know.
That gentleman
and this lady, please.
Bonjour, Michael. Alexis Gilliot. J'ai eu la chance de m'occuper d'un projet de rédaction en plusieurs langues pour diffuser de l'information justement le moins cher possible, notamment en Afrique. Et on s'est posé pas mal de questions au niveau de l'interface, du rôle d'interface qu'on jouait entre, d'une part, les auteurs qu'il faut malgré tout rémunérer. Quand je parle des auteurs, je parle également des traducteurs, etc. Et puis le rôle d'interface avec le public dans la sélection justement de l'information à divulguer. Si on livre au public des millions et des millions de livres, le problème c'est que cette masse d'informations du coup deviendra difficile à gérer, à extraire, comment savoir le bon livre à lire, etc. Est-ce que le projet Gutenberg intègre justement dans son rôle d'interface une gestion donc en amont au niveau des auteurs pour leur permettre de vivre, etc. Et également au niveau du public, la possibilité de leur offrir une sélection et une facilité d'indexation. Merci.